Jamaica's great transformation. How an island nation built its way out of crisis. The morning sun casts long shadows across the construction site where Highway 2000 cuts through the hills of Manchester. Chinese engineers in hard hats cluster around blueprints while Jamaican workers guide massive concrete mixers into position. This isn't just another road project. It's part of the largest infrastructure transformation in Jamaica's history, a $12 billion gamble that the small Caribbean nation can build its way to prosperity. But to understand how Jamaica got here, you have to go back to 2012, when the country was flat broke. "We were on our knees," recalls Finance Minister Nigel Clark, thinking back to those dark days when Jamaica's debt hit 143.9% of GDP, one of the highest debt burdens in the world. The economy hadn't grown in decades. Young people were fleeing to America and Canada by the thousands. The murder rate was climbing toward catastrophic levels. International investors saw Jamaica as a basket case, a beautiful island paradise that couldn't govern itself. The government was spending more on debt payments than on education, healthcare, and infrastructure combined. Every dollar that came in went right back out to bondholders in New York and London. There was no money left to fix the roads, upgrade the ports, or build the digital backbone that modern economies need. Jamaica was stuck in what economists call a debt trap, borrowing more money just to pay the interest on money it had already borrowed. Then something remarkable happened. The island nation that had become synonymous with economic failure did something few countries have ever managed. It dug itself out of the hole without destroying its democracy or abandoning its commitments to its people. The great fiscal turnaround. The transformation didn't happen overnight. It started in 2013 with what many Jamaicans remember as the most painful economic medicine they'd ever swallowed. The government, led by Portia Simpson Miller's People's National Party, struck a deal with the International Monetary Fund that demanded brutal austerity. Public sector wages were frozen. Government spending was slashed. Tax rates went up. For 3 years, ordinary Jamaicans tightened their belts while politicians promised that better days were ahead. Most countries that try this kind of shock therapy fail. Greece tried it and nearly left the European Union. Argentina has tried it multiple times and ended up defaulting anyway. But Jamaica was different. Maybe it was the island's experience with hardship, forged by centuries of struggle. Maybe it was political leadership that somehow convinced people to stick with the program even when it hurt. Whatever the reason, Jamaica did what economists said was impossible. It ran primary budget surpluses, meaning the government collected more in taxes than it spent on everything except debt payments, for year after year after year. "We basically told our people, we're going to have to hurt before we can heal," says Dr. Wayne Henry, Director General of Jamaica's Planning Institute. And somehow they trusted us enough to see it through. The numbers tell the story. By 2024, Jamaica's debt had fallen to 67.9% of GDP. Still high by international standards, but manageable. More importantly, the country was finally collecting more money than it was spending. For the first time in generations, there was fiscal space, actual money, to invest in the future. That's when the infrastructure boom began. The highways come alive. Drive through Jamaica today, and you can't miss the construction. Massive yellow excavators tear into hillsides. Concrete trucks rumble down narrow village roads. Crews in bright orange vests work through the scorching Caribbean heat, building the bones of a new economy. The crown jewel is Highway 2000, a project that started back in the 1990s, but spent years stalled for lack of funding. The completed sections already transformed how Jamaicans live and work, cutting the drive time from Kingston to Spanish Town from an hour in traffic to 20 minutes on a modern toll road. But the real prize has always been extending the highway east and west, opening up the entire island to development. Today, that dream is finally becoming reality. The May Penn to Williamsfield section, completed in 2023, was just the beginning. Construction crews are now racing to finish the Southern Coastal Highway Improvement Project, SCHIP, by March 2027, a $2.5 billion investment that will reshape the entire southern coast. When complete, the highway will run 123 kilometers from Harbor View in the east all the way to Port Antonio, connecting previously isolated communities to the rest of the island. "This isn't just about moving cars faster," explains Robert Morgan, the Works Minister. "This is about opening up land for housing, for business, for tourism. When you build a highway, you're not just building a road, you're building opportunity. The project has faced its share of challenges. Land acquisition has been slow and expensive. Moving utility poles and water lines is tedious work that delays construction. Environmental concerns have required costly design changes. But the government has pushed ahead, driven by a vision of Jamaica as a logistics hub connecting North and South America. Meanwhile, the North Coast Highway project represents an even more ambitious undertaking. The government has partnered with the International Finance Corporation, the World Bank's private sector arm, to design an $800 million public-private partnership that will upgrade 60 kilometers of coastline road from Sea Castles to Mammy Bay. This isn't just any road. It's the artery that connects Jamaica's tourism heartland, running past resort after resort along some of the most beautiful coastline in the Caribbean. "Tourism is our golden goose," says Tourism Minister Edmund Bartlett. "But you can't have a world-class tourism industry running on third-world infrastructure. Our visitors expect to get from the airport to their hotel safely and quickly. Our hotel owners need to be able to move supplies and staff efficiently. This highway is an investment in Jamaica's tourism future, beyond the roads. But Jamaica's infrastructure revolution extends far beyond highways. Walk through Kingston's port, and you'll see massive cranes lifting shipping containers onto trucks bound for the new highways. The port expansion, financed by French shipping giant CMA-CGM, is designed to handle the bigger ships that now pass through the expanded Panama Canal. Jamaica is betting it can become the Caribbean's transshipment hub, the place where goods from Asia get sorted and redistributed to markets across Latin America and the eastern United States. The logic is compelling. Jamaica sits within 800 kilometers of the Panama Canal, perfectly positioned to serve as a logistics gateway. The island's ports have deep water access and room to expand. The new highways will connect the ports to processing zones and airports. If it works, Jamaica could become the Singapore of the Caribbean, a small nation that thrives by making it easier for other people to do business. The government is also investing heavily in digital infrastructure. The National Broadband Network, another public-private partnership advised by the IFC, aims to bring high-speed internet to every corner of the island by 2029. In an economy increasingly driven by remote work and digital services, broadband access isn't a luxury, it's a necessity. "We're not just building roads and ports," says Science and Technology Minister Daryl Vaz. "We're building the foundation for a digital economy. When a young person in rural Portland can access the same internet speeds as someone in New York, that changes everything. They can take online courses, start an e-commerce business, work for companies anywhere in the world. That's the future we're building toward." The numbers are staggering. The government has committed to spend $1 trillion Jamaican dollars, roughly $6.5 billion US, on infrastructure over the next 5 years. It's the largest public investment program in the country's history, touching everything from schools and hospitals to buses and garbage trucks. The PPP revolution. What makes this infrastructure boom possible isn't just Jamaica's improved finances. It's a fundamental shift in how the country approaches big projects. Instead of trying to fund everything from the government budget, Jamaica has embraced public-private partnerships, PPPs, in a big way. The model is elegant in its simplicity. Instead of borrowing money to build a highway, the government finds a private company willing to build, operate, and maintain the road in exchange for toll revenues over 20 or 30 years. The private partner puts up the upfront capital and takes the construction risk. The government gets the infrastructure it needs without adding to the national debt. "PPPs aren't magic," explains Dr. Wesley Hughes, who heads Jamaica's public investment management. "But they're a tool that allows us to build infrastructure we couldn't otherwise afford, while transferring risk to parties better equipped to manage it." The approach has already proven successful. Highway 2000's existing sections were built and are operated by private companies under government concessions. The Norman Manley International Airport was privatized in 2019, leading to immediate improvements in service quality and expansion of routes. Now Jamaica is applying the same model to roads, water systems, hospitals, and even broadband networks. Critics worry about privatizing public assets and whether toll roads will burden ordinary Jamaicans. But supporters point to the alternative: no infrastructure at all. "Perfect is the enemy of good," says one government advisor. We can debate the ideal way to finance infrastructure, or we can build the infrastructure Jamaica needs to compete in the 21st century. The International Finance Corporation's involvement has been crucial. In 2024, the IFC signed a memorandum of understanding with Jamaica to help structure up to 10 different PPP projects worth more than $2 billion. Having the World Bank's private sector arm as an advisor sends a signal to international investors that Jamaica is serious about doing these deals right. Jamaica has become a showcase for how middle-income countries can use PPPs effectively, says Martin Spicer, the IFC's regional director for the Caribbean. The key is having a government that understands the complexities, a legal framework that protects both public and private interests, and institutions that can manage these partnerships over decades. The climate challenge. But Jamaica's infrastructure builders face a challenge that previous generations never had to consider: climate change. The island sits squarely in Hurricane Alley, and rising sea levels threaten coastal roads and ports. The infrastructure being built today has to last for decades, which means designing for a climate that's changing rapidly. Take the Southern Coastal Highway. The original design followed the coastline, taking advantage of flat terrain and scenic views. But hurricane damage and flooding forced engineers back to the drawing board. The new design moves sections inland, elevates bridges, and includes drainage systems designed to handle more intense storms. We're not just building for today's weather, explains Stephen Edwards, managing director of the National Road Operating and Constructing Company. We're building for the weather our grandchildren will face. That means spending more up front, but it means infrastructure that will still be functional in 2050 and beyond. The climate focus has opened up new sources of funding. The IMF's Resilience and Sustainability Facility provides concessional financing for projects that help countries adapt to climate change. The World Bank and other development agencies are prioritizing climate-resilient infrastructure. Jamaica has been able to access this cheaper capital by demonstrating that its projects meet international climate standards. The human cost. For all the impressive statistics and gleaming new infrastructure, it's important to remember that this transformation has a human cost. The highway projects have displaced families and disrupted communities. The austerity measures that made the infrastructure boom possible meant years of sacrifice for ordinary Jamaicans. Take the community of Yalas, where the Southern Coastal Highway cuts through the heart of town. Some residents welcomed the project, knowing it would bring better roads and economic opportunities. Others watched helplessly as their ancestral lands were acquired by the government, often at prices they felt were too low. My great-grandfather built this house with his own hands, says 67-year-old Mavis Campbell, whose property sits in the highway's path. Three generations of my family lived here. Now they tell me I have to move for progress. I understand why they need the road, but that doesn't make it easy to leave everything you know. The government has tried to minimize displacement and provide fair compensation, but large infrastructure projects inevitably disrupt lives, and not everyone who sacrifices for the greater good feels they've been adequately compensated. Similarly, the years of fiscal austerity that preceded the infrastructure boom were genuinely painful for many Jamaicans. Public sector workers went years without raises while inflation ate into their purchasing power. Government services were cut back just when many families were struggling with unemployment and economic hardship. People forget how hard those years were, says Maria Thompson, a teacher in Kingston. We believed in the plan, but believing doesn't put food on the table or help you pay rent when your salary isn't keeping up with prices. A lot of families made real sacrifices to get to where we are today. The regional impact. Jamaica's infrastructure push isn't happening in isolation. It's part of a broader shift in how Caribbean nations think about development and their place in the global economy. For decades, small island states were told their size was a disadvantage. They couldn't achieve economies of scale. They were too small to matter in global supply chains. They would always be dependent on larger neighbors. Jamaica is proving that narrative wrong. By building world-class infrastructure and positioning itself as a regional hub, the island is demonstrating that small size can actually be an advantage if you use it strategically. We may be small, but we're perfectly positioned, says Foreign Minister Kamina Johnson-Smith. We're close to major markets in North and South America. We have deep water ports and plenty of land for expansion. We speak English and have a stable democracy. If we build the right infrastructure, we can punch above our weight economically. The strategy is already working. Other Caribbean nations are watching Jamaica's PPP experiments with keen interest. Barbados is exploring similar models for its airport and port facilities. Trinidad and Tobago is looking at highway PPPs. The Bahamas is studying Jamaica's approach to broadband infrastructure. Jamaica is showing the way forward for the Caribbean, says Sir Hilary Beckles, Vice Chancellor of the University of the West Indies. We can't compete with China or India on size, but we can compete on efficiency, on strategic location, on the quality of our infrastructure and institutions. Jamaica is proving that small island states can thrive in the global economy. Looking ahead, as 2025 draws to a close, Jamaica's infrastructure transformation is far from complete. The North Coast Highway PPP is still being structured, with financial close expected in 2026. The Southern Coastal Highway won't be finished until 2027. The broadband network rollout will continue into the 2030s. But already, the changes are visible. Travel times across the island have been cut dramatically. Port throughput is increasing. Tourist arrivals are setting records. Foreign direct investment is flowing to previously isolated parts of the island. More importantly, Jamaicans are starting to feel optimistic about their country's future. After decades of economic stagnation and emigration, young people are beginning to see opportunities at home. The brain drain that saw Jamaica's best and brightest leave for opportunities abroad is showing signs of slowing, and in some sectors, reversing. My daughter graduated from university last year, and for the first time, she's talking about staying in Jamaica instead of going to Miami or Toronto, says businessman Michael Chin. She sees opportunities here that my generation never had. The new infrastructure is creating possibilities we couldn't have imagined 10 years ago. The transformation isn't just physical, it's psychological. Jamaica is shedding its image as a country that can't get anything done and embracing a new identity as a nation that builds for the future. But infrastructure alone won't solve all of Jamaica's challenges. The roads and ports and broadband networks are just the foundation. The real test will be whether Jamaica can use this infrastructure to build a more prosperous, more equitable society. That brings us to the other half of Jamaica's transformation story, the unprecedented assault on violent crime that has made this infrastructure boom possible. Because you can't build a modern economy if your construction workers are afraid to go to work, your investors are afraid to visit, and your citizens are afraid to leave their homes. The story of how Jamaica brought down its murder rate, from one of the highest in the world to levels not seen in decades, is just as remarkable as the infrastructure transformation. And like the roads and ports rising across the island, it required bold leadership, strategic thinking, and a willingness to try new approaches to old problems. Taking back the streets, the war against crime. The phone call came at 3:47 a.m., jolting Police Commissioner Kevin Blake from sleep. Another shooting in Spanish Town. Three dead, including a teenager. Just another night in Jamaica, where murders had become so common that only the most spectacular cases made headlines. But by 2025, that call would have been extraordinary. Because Jamaica, the island nation that once had the highest murder rate in the world, has achieved something many thought impossible. It has dramatically reduced violent crime while maintaining democratic freedoms and the rule of law. The transformation didn't happen through magic or luck. It happened through a systematic, multi-pronged assault on the gangs, guns, and social conditions that had turned parts of Jamaica into war zones. It happened because political leaders finally decided that enough was enough, and because they were willing to try bold approaches that other countries had been afraid to attempt. The story of how Jamaica reduced its murder rate by more than 40% in just a few years is a story of police transformation, community investment, legislative reform, and political courage. It's also a story of controversy, as the government deployed extraordinary powers that critics worried would undermine human rights and democratic governance. But most of all, it's a story of hope, proof that even the most intractable problems can be solved when societies commit to change and are willing to pay the price for progress. The depth of the crisis. To understand the magnitude of Jamaica's achievement, you have to understand how bad things had gotten. In 2017, Jamaica recorded 1,616 murders, a rate of 58.6 per 100,000 people. That made it the most violent country in the world that wasn't experiencing a civil war. To put that in perspective, the murder rate in the United States, which Americans consider dangerously high, is around 5 per 100,000. In some Jamaican communities, the statistics were even more horrifying. In Kingston's inner-city neighborhoods, young men faced murder rates above 200 per 100,000, higher than most war zones. Children walked to school past crime scenes. Businesses closed early to avoid being caught out after dark. Tourists were warned away from entire sections of the island. The violence wasn't random. Police estimated that 66 to 80% of murders were committed by members of some 300 gangs that had carved up urban Jamaica into territorial fiefdoms. These weren't street corner drug dealers. They were organized criminal enterprises with sophisticated weapons, international connections, and deep roots in their communities. The gangs had become states within the state, explains former National Security Minister Peter Bunting. They controlled territory, collected taxes, settled disputes, and enforced their own version of law and order. In some communities, people were more likely to call a gang leader than the police when they had a problem. The gang's power came from multiple sources. Drug trafficking provided enormous profits, especially from the lottery scamming operations that bilked elderly Americans out of hundreds of millions of dollars. Political patronage dating back decades had given many gangs protection from prosecution. Easy access to illegal firearms, often smuggled from the United States, gave them the tools for violence. And poverty, unemployment, and social exclusion in urban communities provided a steady stream of recruits. The human cost was staggering. Jamaica lost more than 26,000 people to homicide between 2003 and 2025, roughly equivalent to wiping out the entire population of Spanish Town. Each murder represented not just a life lost, but families destroyed, communities terrorized, and economic opportunities squandered. The economic impact was equally devastating. Studies estimated that violence cost Jamaica roughly 4% of GDP annually in lost productivity, security spending, and reduced investment. International businesses were reluctant to locate operations in Jamaica. Tourism, the country's economic lifeline, was constrained to resort enclaves protected by private security. Young professionals emigrated in droves, seeking safety and opportunity abroad. "We had become prisoners in our own country," recalls Kingston businesswoman Angela Chin. "My children couldn't play outside. I couldn't drive through certain neighborhoods, even in broad daylight. We were living in fear, and fear is no way to build a society." The political turning point. The turning point came when Andrew Holness became prime minister in 2016. Holness, a young politician who had grown up in a working-class Kingston neighborhood, understood viscerally how violence was destroying Jamaican society. But he also understood that previous approaches to crime fighting had failed because they were too narrow, too short-term, and too focused on symptoms rather than causes. "Every government before us had declared war on crime," Holness recalls. "But they all focused on getting more police to arrest more criminals. That's necessary, but it's not sufficient. We realized we needed a comprehensive approach that addressed the social, economic, and institutional factors that allow violence to flourish." The result was Plan Secure Jamaica, unveiled in 2018 as a 10-point integrated security and justice roadmap. Unlike previous crime plans, this wasn't just about law enforcement. It included police transformation, legislative reform, community development, border security, and even urban planning, recognizing that poorly designed public spaces can contribute to conflict and violence. "Plan Secure Jamaica was based on a simple insight," explains current National Security Minister Horace Chong. "Crime isn't just a policing problem. It's a symptom of deeper social, economic, and institutional failures. If you want to reduce crime sustainably, you have to address those underlying causes while also ensuring that criminals face swift and certain consequences for their actions." The plan was ambitious, almost to the point of fantasy. It promised to transform one of the world's most violent societies into a place where citizens could feel safe in their communities. Critics called it political posturing. But Holness and his team were deadly serious, and they were willing to use extraordinary measures to achieve extraordinary results. States of emergency and zones of special operations. The government's most controversial tools were states of public emergency, SOEs, and zones of special operations, ZOSOs. Extraordinary security measures that gave police and military forces expanded powers to search, detain, and restrict movement in designated areas. SOEs, which can be declared for up to 30 days at a time, essentially impose martial law in affected parishes. Security forces can search vehicles and people without warrants, detain suspects for extended periods, and impose curfews. The measures had been used sporadically in Jamaica since the 1970s, usually in response to specific crises. ZOSOs, created by legislation passed in 2017, represent a more sustained approach. These zones can be maintained for 60 days at a time, with extensions approved by Parliament. They combine enhanced security powers with social investment programs, following a clear, hold, and build strategy borrowed from counterinsurgency doctrine. The idea is straightforward. First, overwhelm gang strongholds with superior force, arresting leaders and seizing weapons. Then, maintain a continuous security presence while providing basic services and social programs. Finally, invest in infrastructure, education, and economic opportunities to give residents alternatives to criminal activity. The first ZOSO was declared in Mount Salem, St. James in September 2017. The community had been terrorized by the Sparta Gang, one of Jamaica's most violent criminal organizations. Residents lived in constant fear. Businesses had closed. Children were afraid to walk to school. Within weeks of the ZOSO declaration, the transformation was visible. Joint police and military patrols walked the streets 24 hours a day. Illegal weapons were seized. Gang members were arrested or fled to other areas. For the first time in years, children could play outside without fear. But the government didn't stop with security. Social workers moved into the community, helping residents access birth certificates, social services, and job training programs. Infrastructure crews repaired roads, improved drainage, and installed streetlights. Community centers offered after-school programs and conflict resolution workshops. The ZOSO saved Mount Salem, says community leader Jennifer Williams. Before 2017, we were living in hell. The gangs controlled everything. Now my grandchildren can walk to school safely. We have hope again. The success in Mount Salem led to ZOSOs in six other communities. Denham Town and Parade Gardens in Kingston, Greenwich Town and August Town in St. Andrew, Norwood in St. James, and Savannah Lamar in Westmoreland. As of 2025, all seven zones remain active, with Parliament repeatedly extending their mandate based on continued improvements in security and social conditions. The results have been dramatic. Murders in Mount Salem fell by 75% during the first year of the ZOSO. In Savannah Lamar, murders dropped by 83%. Overall, the seven ZOSO communities have seen sustained reductions in all major crimes, even as some violence has been displaced to neighboring areas. But SOEs have been even more controversial. Unlike ZOSOs, which target specific communities with comprehensive development programs, SOEs are emergency measures designed to quickly suppress violence in entire parishes. Between 2017 and 2024, SOEs were declared dozens of times, sometimes covering more than half the island simultaneously. The legal challenges came quickly. In 2020, Jamaica's Supreme Court ruled that extended SOEs without proper legislative oversight were unconstitutional. Human rights groups documented cases of arbitrary detention and excessive force. Opposition politicians accused the government of governing through martial law instead of addressing root causes of crime. SOEs may reduce violence in the short term, but they don't solve the underlying problems, argues human rights lawyer Carolyn Gomez. When you rely on extraordinary powers instead of ordinary policing, you risk normalizing authoritarianism and undermining the rule of law. Government officials acknowledge the concerns, but defend the measures as necessary responses to extraordinary circumstances. They point to lives saved and communities stabilized. They argue that Jamaica's democracy remains strong, with active press criticism, functioning courts, and regular elections. We didn't use these powers lightly, insists Minister Chong. But when you have communities where the murder rate exceeds 200 per 100,000, when children can't go to school because of gang violence, when the state has essentially lost control, those are extraordinary circumstances that justify extraordinary measures. Transforming the police. While SOEs and ZOSOs grabbed headlines, the most important element of Jamaica's crime reduction strategy was the systematic transformation of the Jamaica Constabulary Force, JCF. For decades, the police had been under-resourced, poorly trained, and widely distrusted by the communities they were supposed to serve. The JCF was broken, admits former Police Commissioner Anthony Anderson, who led the force from 2018 to 2024. We had officers working out of buildings that were falling down, with equipment that didn't work, following procedures that hadn't been updated since the 1960s. We had lost the trust of large segments of the population. You can't fight crime effectively under those conditions. The transformation began with infrastructure. The government launched Project ROC, Rebuild, Overhaul, and Construct, a comprehensive program to upgrade police facilities across the island. Over 5 years, 130 police facilities were rehabilitated or replaced, including 11 brand new, fit-for-purpose police stations with proper reception areas, interview rooms, and detention facilities. But buildings were just the beginning. The JCF overhauled its recruitment, training, and promotion systems. New officers now receive 6 months of intensive training, including courses on human rights, community policing, and de-escalation techniques. Veteran officers attend regular refresher courses and specialized training programs. Technology upgrades were equally important. The force deployed new communication systems, forensic laboratories, and database management tools. Officers received body-worn cameras and new vehicles. A new intelligence system allowed different units to share information in real time. Perhaps most importantly, the JCF adopted a new operational philosophy based on intelligence-led policing and community engagement. Instead of responding to crimes after they happened, police began using data analysis to predict where crimes were likely to occur and deploying resources proactively. We stopped playing defense and started playing offense, explains current police commissioner Dr. Kevin Blake. Instead of waiting for gang members to shoot each other, we used intelligence to identify the gangs, map their structures, and systematically dismantle their operations. The results were remarkable. In 2025, police identified 85 active gangs across all 19 police divisions, down 29% from 120 gangs in 2024. Since the start of 2025, security forces have targeted 63 gangs, leading to the arrest of 159 known gang members and charges against 34 others. 15 gang members have been charged under anti-gang legislation, with 10 major gang cases involving over 90 individuals currently before the courts. But the transformation wasn't just about being tougher on criminals. It was also about being more responsive to communities. The JCF created a new beat officer patrol division focused on community engagement. Officers began holding regular community meetings, participating in youth programs, and working with local leaders to address quality of life issues. The old model was us versus them, explains Superintendent Patricia Campbell, who oversees community policing in Kingston. Police would show up after something bad happened, make arrests, and leave. The new model is about being part of the community, building relationships, preventing crime before it happens. The approach has helped rebuild trust between police and communities that had been alienated for decades. Public opinion surveys show steadily improving confidence in the JCF, particularly among young people who had grown up viewing police as enemies rather than protectors. Legislative warfare. Jamaica's assault on crime also included a comprehensive overhaul of the legal framework governing everything from gang membership to firearms possession. The government recognized that even the best policing couldn't succeed if criminals faced weak penalties or lengthy court delays. The centerpiece was the Anti-Gang Act, originally passed in 2014, but significantly strengthened in 2021. The law makes it a crime simply to participate in a criminal organization, allowing prosecutors to target gang members even when they can't prove involvement in specific crimes. It also creates conspiracy-type charges that make it easier to prosecute gang leaders who order violence without directly participating. The first major test came with the Yardies trial, which targeted 33 members of one of Kingston's most notorious gangs. Using evidence gathered through wiretaps, surveillance, and cooperating witnesses, prosecutors were able to demonstrate the gang's structure and criminal activities. All 33 defendants were convicted, with sentences ranging up to 25 years in prison. The Anti-Gang Act changed the game, explains Director of Public Prosecutions Paula Llewellyn. Before, we had to prosecute gang members one crime at a time, which was difficult and often ineffective. Now we can treat gangs as criminal organizations and prosecute membership itself as a crime. The government also dramatically increased penalties for firearms offenses. The new Firearms Act, passed in 2022, imposes a mandatory 15-year minimum sentence for illegal gun possession. In the first 9 months after implementation, 247 people were charged under the new law. Court reforms were equally important. The government created specialized gun courts to fast-track firearms cases and reduce the backlog that had allowed many criminals to remain free on bail for years. New case management systems improved efficiency and reduced delays. "Justice delayed is justice denied," says Chief Justice Brian Sykes. "When it takes 3 or 4 years to bring a case to trial, witnesses disappear, evidence degrades, and criminals feel they can act with impunity. We've cut case processing times dramatically, and criminals are starting to understand that they will face swift consequences for their actions." Community transformation. But laws and police work alone couldn't address the social conditions that made gang recruitment so easy in Jamaica's inner cities. The government recognized that sustainable crime reduction required comprehensive community development in the areas where violence was most concentrated. The centerpiece of this effort is the Community Renewal Program, which targets 105 vulnerable communities with integrated social, economic, and infrastructure investments. The program, administered by the Jamaica Social Investment Fund, JSIF, receives approximately $2.13 billion annually and touches everything from education and job training to housing and healthcare. In Zoso communities, the transformation has been particularly dramatic. Take Denham Town in West Kingston, one of Jamaica's most notorious neighborhoods. Before the Zoso was declared in 2018, the community was controlled by the infamous One Order Gang. Shootings were a nightly occurrence. Most businesses had closed. Residents were afraid to leave their homes after dark. Today, Denham Town looks like a different place. New streetlights illuminate previously dark corners where criminals once lurked. A renovated community center offers computer classes and job training programs. A new clinic provides healthcare services that residents previously couldn't access. Youth sports leagues give teenagers alternatives to gang involvement. "It's like we're living in a different community," says resident Marsha Brown, who has lived in Denham Town for 30 years. "My grandson can play football in the park. I can walk to the shop in the evening. We have hope that our children can have a better life than we did." The government has also invested heavily in education and job training, recognizing that young people without economic opportunities are easy targets for gang recruitment. Programs range from basic literacy classes to advanced technical training in fields like automotive repair and computer programming. "We realize that you can't just take away the negative options," explains Social Security Minister Juliette Cuthbert Flynn. "You have to provide positive alternatives. That means education, job training, and economic opportunities. It means showing young people that there's a legal path to success and respect." The approach extends beyond individual programs to broader community development. In many Zoso areas, the government has upgraded water systems, improved drainage, and rebuilt roads. Houses built with zinc sheets and board have been replaced with concrete structures. Informal settlements have been regularized, giving residents legal ownership of their homes for the first time. When people have a stake in their community, when they own their homes, when their children attend good schools, when they have jobs with decent wages, they don't support criminal activity, observes Dr. Damian King, an economist who has studied Jamaica's violence reduction efforts. Community development isn't just about being nice to people. It's about changing the incentive structure that makes crime attractive. International cooperation. Jamaica's crime reduction efforts have also benefited from unprecedented international cooperation, particularly with the United States, which has a strong interest in reducing drug trafficking and gang activity that affects American communities. The U.S. has provided training, equipment, and intelligence support to Jamaican security forces. The Drug Enforcement Administration maintains a significant presence in Jamaica, working with local police to target major trafficking organizations. The FBI has helped Jamaica modernize its forensic capabilities and database systems. "The criminal networks we're fighting don't respect borders," explains U.S. Ambassador to Jamaica N. Nicholas Perry. "Jamaican gangs operate in American cities, and American weapons fuel violence in Jamaica. We have to work together to break these connections." The cooperation has produced dramatic results. Joint operations have dismantled several major drug trafficking organizations and disrupted lottery scamming networks that victimized thousands of Americans. Intelligence sharing has led to arrests on both sides of the border. But the partnership goes beyond law enforcement. The U.S. has also supported community development programs, particularly those focused on youth engagement and violence interruption. Programs like the Citizen Security and Justice Program, funded by the European Union, provide social services and conflict resolution support in high-violence communities. We've learned that sustainable crime reduction requires more than just better policing, says EU Ambassador Marianne Van Steen. It requires addressing the root causes of violence, poverty, inequality, lack of opportunity, weak institutions. That's where international development assistance can make a real difference. The human rights debate. Despite the dramatic reduction in violence, Jamaica's crime-fighting strategy remains controversial, particularly regarding human rights and civil liberties. Critics argue that SOEs and ZOSOs represent an authoritarian approach that undermines democratic governance and disproportionately affects poor, predominantly Black communities. Human rights organizations have documented cases of arbitrary detention, excessive force, and violations of due process rights. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has expressed concern about the extensive use of emergency powers. Some legal scholars worry that Jamaica is normalizing authoritarianism in the name of crime reduction. We can't save Jamaica's democracy by destroying it, argues human rights lawyer Isaac Buchanan. Yes, crime is a serious problem, but so is the erosion of constitutional rights. When governments govern through emergency powers rather than ordinary law, when they detain people without charge for extended periods, when they restrict freedom of movement and assembly, those are the hallmarks of authoritarianism, not democracy. Government officials acknowledge these concerns, but argue that extraordinary circumstances justify extraordinary measures. They point to safeguards built into the system. SOEs require legislative approval, courts continue to function independently, and press freedom remains intact. They also argue that the right to life and security is the most fundamental human right of all. "We didn't take these measures lightly," insists Attorney General Marlene Malahoforte. "But when you have communities where children can't go to school because of gang violence, where families are terrorized in their own homes, where the state has effectively lost control, you have a responsibility to act. The greatest human rights violation is allowing innocent people to live in fear." The debate reflects a broader tension in criminology and human rights law. How do societies balance public safety with individual rights? How much liberty are citizens willing to sacrifice for security? How do you defeat criminal organizations without becoming authoritarian yourself? Jamaica's experience suggests that the answer may depend on context, implementation, and democratic oversight. The country has maintained competitive elections, press freedom, and judicial independence even while deploying extraordinary security measures. Critics remain vigilant, but polls show most Jamaicans support the government's approach. "Perfect is the enemy of good," argues political scientist Anthony Harriet of the University of the West Indies. Yes, there have been human rights concerns, and those need to be addressed. But we also need to recognize that thousands of lives have been saved. Families that lived in terror now feel safe. Children who couldn't go to school are getting an education. That has to count for something. The regional impact. Jamaica's success in reducing violence is being watched closely across the Caribbean, where many countries face similar challenges with gang violence and drug trafficking. Trinidad and Tobago, the Bahamas, and other nations are studying Jamaica's approach to see what lessons might apply to their own contexts. The timing is crucial. Gang violence is rising across the Caribbean, fueled by drug trafficking routes, weapons flows, and social inequality. Countries that previously felt insulated from Jamaica's problems are now experiencing similar challenges. "What's happening in Jamaica today could be happening in Barbados or Trinidad tomorrow," warns security analyst Dr. Ivlaw Griffith. "These criminal networks are transnational. The social conditions that breed violence exist throughout the region. Jamaica has shown that it's possible to turn things around, but it requires political will, sustained investment, and coordinated action." Some countries are already adapting Jamaican innovations. Trinidad has created specialized anti-gang courts modeled on Jamaica's gun courts. The Bahamas is studying Jamaica's ZOSO model for addressing gang strongholds in Nassau. Barbados is exploring community policing initiatives similar to Jamaica's Beat Officer program. But regional cooperation is also crucial. Gang networks operate across borders, and violence in one country affects the entire region's reputation and tourism industry. Caribbean leaders are increasingly recognizing that citizen security is a shared challenge requiring coordinated responses. "We're all in this together," says CARICOM Secretary General Dr. Carla Barnett. A murder in Kingston affects tourism in Barbados. Drug trafficking through Jamaica impacts security in Trinidad. "We need to work together to address these challenges, sharing intelligence, best practices, and resources." Looking forward, as Jamaica enters 2026, the violence reduction efforts continue to evolve. The government is working to transition from emergency measures to sustainable, community-based approaches. New legislation aims to provide judicial oversight for extended security operations while maintaining their effectiveness. The police transformation is far from complete. While the JCF has made remarkable progress, it still faces challenges in areas like forensic capacity, digital investigations, and community trust building. Continued investment in training, technology, and infrastructure will be essential. Community development remains a long-term project. While ZOSO areas have seen dramatic improvements, many other vulnerable communities still lack basic services and economic opportunities. Expanding successful programs to all 105 communities identified as at risk will require sustained political commitment and financial resources. The legislative framework continues to evolve as well. Courts are still processing the first generation of anti-gang cases, establishing precedents that will shape future prosecutions. The effectiveness of mandatory minimum sentences and other tough-on-crime measures remains a subject of ongoing evaluation and debate. Perhaps most importantly, Jamaica must sustain political and social commitment to violence reduction even as the immediate crisis appears to be passing. History shows that crime can return quickly if societies become complacent or if underlying conditions deteriorate. "We've made tremendous progress, but we can't declare victory yet," cautions Prime Minister Holness. "Reducing violence from catastrophic levels to merely high levels is an achievement, but our goal is to make Jamaica as safe as any country in the world. That's going to require sustained effort over many years." The early results are encouraging. Jamaica's murder rate, which peaked at nearly 60 per 100,000 in 2017, is projected to fall below 25 per 100,000 by the end of 2025. If that happens, it will represent the lowest level of violence in over three decades. More importantly, the reduction in violence has created space for the kinds of long-term development that can break cycles of poverty and crime. Children who once couldn't attend school regularly are now getting educations that can lift them out of poverty. Young people who might have joined gangs are instead participating in job training programs and community development projects. The transformation of Jamaica from one of the world's most violent societies to a place where people can feel safe walking their own neighborhoods represents one of the most dramatic crime reduction success stories in recent history. It shows that even the most intractable problems can be solved with the right combination of political will, strategic thinking, and sustained commitment. But it also demonstrates that there are no easy answers to complex social problems. Jamaica's approach combined tough law enforcement with massive social investment, emergency powers with democratic oversight, international cooperation with community engagement. The formula worked, but it required difficult trade-offs and remained controversial throughout. As other countries grapple with rising violence and citizen insecurity, Jamaica's experience offers both hope and hard-won wisdom about what it takes to reclaim communities from criminal control and build societies where all citizens can live in safety and dignity. Building Dreams, the human story behind the numbers. The sun is setting over Harbor View as Marva Johnson watches her 12-year-old grandson Malik walk home from school. 3 years ago, she would never have let him make this journey alone. Not through a neighborhood where gunshots echoed nightly and gang members controlled the corners. Today, Malik stops to chat with Police Constable Brown, who knows every child in the community by name, before heading home to work on homework at the new community center that stays open until 9 p.m. This is the real story of Jamaica's transformation. Not the billions spent on highways or the statistics about crime reduction, but the way ordinary people's lives have changed. The way children can play outside again. the way businesses stay open after dark, the way young people talk about their futures with hope instead of resignation. Walk through any of Jamaica's zone of special operations, ZOSO, communities today, and you'll see the infrastructure, new roads, better streetlights, renovated schools, upgraded water systems. But if you talk to the people who live there, you'll hear about something more profound. The restoration of social fabric, the return of civic life, the rebuilding of communities that had been torn apart by decades of violence and neglect. Where it all began, Mount Salem's miracle. To understand how transformation happens one community at a time, start in Mount Salem, St. James, the first community to receive a ZOSO declaration in September 2017. Before that date, Mount Salem was synonymous with violence. The area was controlled by the Sparta Gang, one of Jamaica's most feared criminal organizations. Residents lived in constant terror. Children stayed inside after school. Businesses closed early or shuttered altogether. It was like living in a war zone, recalls Jennifer Williams, a 45-year-old mother of three who has lived in Mount Salem her entire life. You couldn't walk to the shop without wondering if you'd make it home. My children slept on the floor because we were afraid of stray bullets coming through the windows. It wasn't living, it was just surviving. The Sparta Gang didn't just control drug sales, they controlled everything. They decided who could operate businesses, who could hold events, even who could walk through certain areas. They collected their own taxes and settled disputes through violence. For many residents, the gang leaders were more powerful and more present than any government official. Then came September 1, 2017. Jennifer remembers the day vividly because it was the first time in years she had seen so many uniformed officers in her community. Not just police, but soldiers too, setting up checkpoints and beginning house-to-house searches. Some residents were suspicious. Others were hopeful. Everyone was nervous. At first, we didn't know what to expect, Jennifer says. We'd seen police operations before, but they would come for a few days and then leave, and the gangs would come back stronger. This felt different because they weren't just arresting people. They were staying. The initial phase was intense. Security forces conducted searches, arrested suspected gang members, and seized weapons and drugs. For several weeks, Mount Salem felt like an occupied territory, with checkpoints and patrols around the clock. Some residents complained about harassment and inconvenience. Others celebrated the absence of gunfire. But then something unprecedented happened. The government started building. Construction crews arrived to fix roads that hadn't been properly maintained in decades. Drainage systems were upgraded to prevent flooding during hurricane season. Streetlights went up in areas that had been dark for years. The community center, which had been vandalized and abandoned, was completely renovated with new computers, meeting rooms, and recreational facilities. That's when we knew this wasn't just another police operation, Jennifer explains. When you see them spending money to fix your roads, to put up streetlights, to give your children a place to study, that's when you realize they plan to stay and make things better. More importantly, social workers and community development specialists moved into Mount Salem. They helped residents apply for birth certificates. Many people in Jamaica's inner cities lack proper identification documents. They organized job training programs, health screenings, and educational workshops. They mediated disputes that might otherwise have turned violent. The impact was measurable almost immediately. In the year before the ZOSO, Mount Salem recorded 23 murders. In the first year after, there were just 12, a 48% reduction. Shootings, robberies, and other serious crimes fell even more dramatically. But the statistics don't capture what residents experienced emotionally. For the first time in decades, children could play outside without fear. Small businesses reopened. Community events returned. People began investing in their homes again, painting houses and planting gardens that they had been afraid to maintain when violence was constant. My grandson started sleeping in his own bed instead of on the floor, Jennifer says, tearing up. That might sound like a small thing, but for a grandmother who had watched her family live in fear for years, it was everything. The ripple effect. How safety changes everything. The transformation in Mount Salem created ripple effects that went far beyond crime statistics. When violence decreases, everything else becomes possible. Schools can function normally. Businesses can operate profitably. Community organizations can plan events. People can invest in relationships and long-term goals, instead of just trying to survive each day. Take education, for example. Before the Zoso, attendance at Mount Salem Primary School was spotty because parents were afraid to send their children out during periods of gang warfare. Teachers struggled to maintain order in classrooms where children were traumatized by constant exposure to violence. Academic achievement was poor because learning is difficult when you're constantly afraid. After the Zoso, everything changed. Attendance rates improved dramatically because parents felt safe sending their children to school. Teachers could focus on education instead of security. Test scores began rising as children who had been distracted by fear could concentrate on learning. The children are different now, observes Paulette Brown, who has taught at Mount Salem Primary for 15 years. Before, they were anxious, aggressive, always looking over their shoulders. Now they're just children, curious, playful, focused on their studies. It's amazing what happens when fear is removed from their lives. The school itself was transformed too. The government invested in new classrooms, updated textbooks, and computer equipment. The playground, which had been too dangerous to use, was renovated and expanded. After-school programs were introduced, keeping children engaged in positive activities instead of being recruited by gangs. Similarly, small businesses began returning to Mount Salem for the first time in years. Beauty salons, restaurants, and retail shops opened or expanded operations. A new pharmacy meant residents no longer had to travel to other communities for basic medications. A small grocery store extended its hours because owners no longer feared being robbed after dark. Business is completely different now, says Carlton Miller, who operates a small restaurant in Mount Salem. Before the Zoso, I had to close at 5 p.m. because it wasn't safe to be open at night. I lost money every day because people were afraid to come out. Now I stay open until 10 p.m., and weekends are busy with families eating out, young people socializing. It's like having a normal community again. The economic impact extends beyond individual businesses. Property values in Mount Salem have increased significantly as the area became safer and more desirable. Residents who had been trapped in a depreciating asset suddenly found themselves with valuable equity. Some used this to improve their homes further. Others started small businesses or invested in their children's education. But perhaps the most important change has been psychological. For decades, residents of communities like Mount Salem felt abandoned by the government and stigmatized by the broader society. They were seen as criminals or gang sympathizers simply because of where they lived. The comprehensive investment in their community sent a different message. You matter, your lives have value, Jamaica includes you too. For the first time, I felt like the government cared about us, Jennifer reflects. Not just about stopping the violence, but about giving us a chance to build something better. When you feel like society has written you off, it's hard to invest in the future. But when you see them investing in you, it changes everything. Denham Town, from Murder Central to Community Pride. If Mount Salem was Jamaica's proof of concept for community transformation, Denham Town in West Kingston was the ultimate test. Known as Murder Central, this inner-city community had been synonymous with violence for decades. It was the birthplace of some of Jamaica's most notorious gangs and the site of countless turf wars that claimed hundreds of lives. The community's problems ran deeper than gang violence. Denham Town had been neglected by successive governments, lacking basic infrastructure and services. Many residents lived in zinc shacks without proper water or sewage systems. Streets were unpaved and poorly drained, flooding regularly during rainy season. The nearest hospital was miles away, and police rarely ventured into the area except in large, heavily armed groups. Denham Town was forgotten, says 52-year-old resident Marsha Brown, who moved to the community as a young woman and raised four children there. We felt like we weren't part of Jamaica. The government would promise things during election campaigns, but after the votes were counted, they forgot about us. We were left to survive on our own. That survival often meant accommodation with criminal elements who provided services the state didn't. Gang leaders mediated disputes, provided loans for emergencies, and offered protection from rival groups. In return, they expected loyalty and silence. It was a Faustian bargain that trapped communities in cycles of violence and criminality. The Zoso Declaration in Denham Town came in January 2018, following a spike in murders that made headlines across Jamaica. Unlike Mount Salem, where residents were cautiously optimistic, Denham Town greeted the security forces with suspicion and hostility. This was a community that had been over-policed and underserved for decades, where interactions with law enforcement were typically violent and unproductive. At first, we thought it was just another harassment operation, Marsha recalls. Police would come in, rough up the youth, arrest some people, and leave everything worse than before. We'd seen it many times. Why should this be different? The difference became apparent gradually. Yes, there were searches and arrests. 38 people were detained in the first month, and several high-powered weapons were seized. But there was also immediate investment in the community's infrastructure and social services. Within weeks, construction crews were upgrading the main road that had been nearly impassable. New streetlights were installed, transforming areas that had been dark and dangerous. The community center, which had been vandalized and abandoned, was completely renovated with new equipment and programming. More importantly, social workers and community development officers moved into Denham Town, setting up offices and holding regular meetings with residents. They helped people navigate government bureaucracy, access social services, and resolve conflicts without violence. They organized programs for youth, elderly residents, and families. That's when we realized this wasn't just about police and soldiers, Marsha explains. When social workers started coming to our community meetings, when they helped my neighbor get her pension sorted out, when they started programs for the young people. That's when we knew they were serious about helping us, not just controlling us. The transformation was remarkable. Murders in Denham Town fell from 31 in 2017 to just 16 in 2018, a 48% reduction. More importantly, the community began to feel normal again. Children played in the streets. Adults sat outside in the evenings, socializing with neighbors. Community events resumed after years of cancellation due to security concerns. The physical transformation was equally dramatic. Houses that had been built with zinc sheets and scrap wood were upgraded or replaced with concrete structures. Gardens appeared as residents felt secure enough to invest in beautification. Small businesses opened for the first time in years. But the most significant change was psychological. Residents who had felt abandoned and stigmatized began to take pride in their community again. They organized cleaning campaigns, crime watch groups, and community events. They began holding government officials accountable for promises made. We stopped being victims and started being citizens again, Marsha says. When you feel like you have a stake in your community, when you believe it can be better, you act differently. You take care of things. You hold people accountable. You invest in the future. The youth factor, breaking cycles of violence. One of the most important aspects of Jamaica's community transformation has been its focus on young people. The demographic group most at risk of gang recruitment and most likely to perpetrate or become victims of violence. In communities like Denham Town and Mount Salem, teenage boys faced a stark choice: join a gang or risk being victimized by gangs. There were few legitimate economic opportunities, and schools often functioned poorly due to security concerns and resource constraints. For many young men, gangs offered identity, protection, income, and respect. Everything that mainstream society seemed to deny them. The gangs were recruiting children as young as 12, explains youth worker Kemar Johnson, who has worked in Kingston's inner cities for over a decade. They would give them phones, money, nice clothes, things their families couldn't afford. They made gang life seem glamorous and exciting compared to the poverty and boredom of legitimate alternatives. The Zoso strategy recognized that sustainable violence reduction required giving young people better options. Each Zoso community received extensive youth programming, including job training, sports leagues, mentorship programs, and educational support. In Mount Salem, for example, the renovated community center became a hub of youth activity. Computer classes taught basic digital literacy skills. A recording studio allowed aspiring musicians to pursue careers in music instead of crime. Sports programs provided positive outlets for competition and aggression. The young people needed to see that there were other ways to gain respect and income, observes Community Development Officer Sharon Blake, who coordinates youth programs in Mount Salem. Gang leaders were their role models because they were the only successful people they saw. We had to show them legitimate role models and create pathways to legitimate success. The programs have been remarkably successful. In Mount Salem, youth participation in gangs has virtually disappeared. Young people who might have been recruited into criminal activity are instead participating in job training programs, attending school regularly, and planning for legitimate careers. Take 19-year-old Damian Williams, no relation to Jennifer, who was 16 when the Zoso began in Mount Salem. Before 2017, he was struggling in school, frequently absent, and had been approached by gang members about earning some money. His future seemed bleak. "I was angry all the time," Damian recalls. "Angry about living in poverty, angry about feeling powerless, angry about being written off by society. The gang members understood that anger and offered me a way to channel it, but in destructive ways." Today, Damian is completing a certificate in automotive repair through a Zoso-sponsored training program. He works part-time at a garage and plans to start his own business within a few years. More importantly, he has become a mentor for younger boys in his community, steering them away from the gang recruitment that nearly claimed him. "The program saved my life," he says simply. "They showed me that I could have a future without violence, that my community could be proud of me for building things up instead of tearing things down. Now I want to help other young people see those same possibilities." Similar stories are playing out across all 7 Zoso communities. Young people who were considered at risk are instead becoming community assets, completing their education, starting businesses, raising families, and contributing to the social and economic development of their neighborhoods. The impact extends beyond individual success stories. When young people in a community are pursuing legitimate opportunities instead of criminal activities, it changes the entire social dynamic. Parents have hope for their children's futures. Community leaders have positive examples to point to. The culture begins shifting from one that tolerated or even celebrated criminal success to one that values legitimate achievement. Women as change agents. One of the most important but underreported aspects of Jamaica's community transformation has been the central role played by women as leaders, organizers, and change agents. In communities devastated by male-dominated gang violence, women have often been the ones holding families and neighborhoods together, maintaining social institutions, and advocating for change. This was certainly true in communities like Denham Town and Mount Salem, where women like Jennifer Williams and Marsha Brown had been quietly working for years to protect their families and maintain some semblance of community life, even during the worst periods of violence. When the Zoso programs began, these women emerged as natural leaders and partners for community development efforts. They organized residents' meetings, advocated for specific improvements, and held both government officials and community members accountable for their commitments. "The women were our secret weapon," admits Community Development Officer Sharon Blake. "They understood their communities better than any outsider ever could. They knew which young people were at risk, which families needed help, which programs would work, and which wouldn't. Most importantly, they had credibility with residents who were suspicious of government intentions." Women's leadership has been particularly important in addressing the trauma and social disruption caused by years of violence. In many Zoso communities, women have organized support groups for families affected by violence, conflict resolution workshops, and community healing ceremonies that help residents process their experiences and move forward. "We had to heal as a community before we could build as a community," explains Grace Thompson, a community leader in Denham Town. "Too many people had lost family members to violence. Too many children had been traumatized. Too many families had been torn apart. The women understood that you can't just put up new streetlights and expect everything to be okay. You have to address the emotional wounds too." Women have also been crucial in changing community attitudes toward violence and criminal activity. In the past, gang leaders often enjoyed support from women in their communities, mothers, girlfriends, and wives who saw them as providers and protectors. Shifting those attitudes has been essential to sustainable violence reduction. "We had to have honest conversations about our own role in perpetuating violence," Grace admits. "Some of us had sons, brothers, or boyfriends involved in gangs. We had to stop making excuses and start demanding better. That was hard, but it was necessary." The results have been profound. Communities where women have taken leadership roles in development efforts have seen more sustainable improvements and less violence than those where men have dominated decision-making. Women's organizations have become powerful voices for continued investment and reform. Economic transformation, from survival to prosperity. The most visible changes in Zoso communities have been physical: new roads, better lighting, renovated buildings. But the most important changes may be economic. When violence decreases and basic infrastructure improves, it creates conditions for legitimate economic activity to flourish. This has been dramatically evident in communities like Mount Salem and Denham Town, where small businesses have returned for the first time in years. Beauty salons, restaurants, grocery stores, and service providers have opened or expanded operations, creating jobs and keeping money circulating within the community instead of fleeing to safer areas. The impact goes beyond individual businesses. When economic activity increases, property values rise, giving residents equity they can leverage for further investment. Tax revenues increase, providing resources for continued infrastructure improvements. Young people see legitimate pathways to economic success, reducing the appeal of criminal alternatives. It's a virtuous cycle, explains economist Dr. Damian King of the University of the West Indies. Safety enables economic activity, which creates jobs and investment, which strengthens communities, which makes them safer, which enables more economic activity. The challenge is getting the cycle started, but once it begins, it can be self-reinforcing. The government has deliberately tried to accelerate this process through targeted economic development programs. In each Zoso community, officials have worked with residents to identify economic opportunities and provide support for entrepreneurs and small businesses. In Mount Salem, for example, a group of women organized a catering cooperative that provides services for community events and private parties. In Denham Town, young men have started a landscaping business that maintains gardens and common areas throughout the community. In Greenwich Town, residents have opened a small manufacturing workshop that produces furniture for local sale. These may seem like small-scale initiatives, but their impact on community psychology has been enormous. They demonstrate that legitimate economic success is possible, provide positive role models for young people, and create networks of stakeholders with interests in maintaining peace and stability. When people have businesses to protect, when they have jobs that depend on community stability, when they're making money from legitimate activities, they become invested in maintaining peace, observes Sharon Blake. Economic development isn't just about improving living standards. It's about changing incentives and creating stakeholders in community success. Challenges and setbacks. Jamaica's community transformation success story isn't without challenges and setbacks. Even in the most successful Zoso communities, problems remain. Unemployment is still high, particularly among young men. Some families continue to struggle with poverty and lack of opportunities. Social problems like domestic violence and substance abuse persist. Moreover, violence hasn't been eliminated. It has been reduced and in some cases displaced to other areas. Gang members who fled Zoso communities have sometimes established operations elsewhere, creating new security challenges for communities that weren't receiving the same level of intervention and investment. We can't just focus on 7 communities and ignore the other 100 plus that are struggling with similar issues, acknowledges National Security Minister Horace Chong. The Zoso model has proven effective, but we need to find ways to scale up successful interventions and extend them to all vulnerable communities. There have also been concerns about sustainability. The intensive government investment that transforms Zoso communities, estimated at several billion dollars annually, may not be maintainable indefinitely. As the immediate crisis passes and political attention shifts to other priorities, there's a risk that communities could regress if support is withdrawn too quickly. Some residents worry about this possibility. We've seen politicians make promises before and then forget about us after the cameras leave, says Marsha Brown in Denham Town. This time feels different because of how much they've invested, but we're still watching to make sure they keep their commitments. There are also legitimate concerns about the methods used to achieve community transformation. The combination of enhanced security powers, military-style operations, and restrictions on movement has been controversial, with critics arguing that it represents an authoritarian approach to social problems. Human rights advocates have documented cases of arbitrary detention, excessive force, and violations of due process rights in Zoso communities. While most residents support the overall approach, some have complained about harassment by security forces and restrictions on their freedom of movement. We're grateful for the improvements in our community, but we shouldn't have to give up our rights to live safely, argues human rights lawyer Carolyn Gomez. A truly democratic society should be able to provide security and development without resorting to emergency powers and military-style occupation. The path forward. Despite these challenges, the transformation of Jamaica's most violent communities represents one of the most successful violence reduction and community development initiatives in recent history. The combination of enhanced security, massive infrastructure investment, and comprehensive social programming has demonstrated that even the most troubled communities can be turned around with sufficient political will and resources. The key lessons from Jamaica's experience are applicable far beyond the Caribbean. First, sustainable violence reduction requires addressing root causes, not just symptoms. Police operations and tough laws can suppress violence temporarily, but lasting change requires economic opportunity, social investment, and community engagement. Second, community transformation requires comprehensive, coordinated interventions. It's not enough to improve security without addressing economic conditions. It's not enough to build infrastructure without investing in human development. Successful interventions must address the multiple, interconnected factors that contribute to community dysfunction. Third, local leadership and community ownership are essential. External interventions can provide resources and technical expertise, but lasting change must be driven by residents themselves. Women, in particular, have proven to be crucial leaders and change agents in community transformation efforts. Finally, sustained commitment is essential. Community transformation is a long-term process that requires consistent investment and attention over many years. Quick fixes and short-term interventions may provide temporary relief, but they won't address the deep-seated problems that took decades to develop. As Jamaica looks toward the future, the challenge is extending successful interventions to the many communities that still struggle with violence, poverty, and social dysfunction. The government has identified 105 vulnerable communities that need attention, but resources are limited and political attention is finite. The solution may be scaling up successful models while adapting them to local conditions. Not every community needs the intensive intervention that ZOSO areas received, but every community deserves access to basic services, economic opportunities, and effective governance. A model for the world. Jamaica's community transformation experience offers hope for societies around the world struggling with violence, poverty, and social breakdown. From the favelas of Brazil to the townships of South Africa, from the inner cities of the United States to the refugee camps of the Middle East, communities everywhere face similar challenges of marginalization, violence, and neglect. Jamaica's success demonstrates that these problems are not intractable. With sufficient political will, strategic investment, and comprehensive programming, even the most troubled communities can be transformed. The island nation has shown that small countries with limited resources can still achieve remarkable results when they commit to inclusive development and effective governance. The transformation of places like Mount Salem and Denham Town from gang-controlled territories to thriving communities represents more than just successful crime reduction. It represents the restoration of human dignity, the renewal of social solidarity, and the revival of hope for the future. As Jennifer Williams in Mount Salem watches her grandson Malik walk safely home from school, she embodies the human impact of Jamaica's transformation. Her family's story, from fear to hope, from survival to prosperity, from exclusion to citizenship, is being replicated in communities across Jamaica and offers a template for change agents everywhere. "My grandson will grow up in a different Jamaica than I did," Jennifer reflects. "He'll grow up believing that his community matters, that his life has value, that his dreams are possible. That's the real measure of our success. Not the statistics about crime reduction or the billions spent on infrastructure, but the fact that our children can dream again. That restoration of hope, for individuals, families, and entire communities, may be Jamaica's greatest achievement." In a world often dominated by cynicism and despair, the island nation has demonstrated that transformation is possible, that societies can choose progress over decline, and that every community deserves the chance to build a better future. The highways and reduced crime rates are impressive, but they're just the foundation. The real prize is what Jennifer sees in her grandson's eyes. The confidence that comes from living in a society that invests in its people, the security that comes from effective governance, and the hope that comes from believing that tomorrow can be better than today. That's the Jamaica being built today. One road, one community, one child at a time.